from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
This is
War News Radio.
I'm Anjali Kadambi.
And I'm Marina Tuk-Tuk.
This week on War News Radio, Asking and Telling, we hear from opponents of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Then we speak to some Iraqis who fled to Syria after 2003 about their lives in exile.
Finally, we examine peace movements in Afghanistan, including President Karzai's own peace jirga.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki took major steps towards securing a governing coalition in Iraq this week. His mostly Shiite party recently won the support of followers of Muqtada al-Sadr, a prominent anti-American Shiite cleric. The new coalition, with supporters of both al-Maliki and Sadr, is about 30 votes shy of a parliamentary majority. Because Kurdish members of parliament are expected to ultimately join this alliance, the new move puts al-Maliki on the verge of another term in office. Al-Maliki also reached out to the secular Iraqiya party led by former interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. The tentative deal, which Iraqiya has not agreed to, is expected to leave al-Maliki as Prime Minister, but grant Alawi another high-profile government position.
Iraq's oil minister increased the estimate of the country's oil reserves by 24% this week, up to 140 billion barrels. The announcement reflects new data and extraction efforts since the last time the reserves were estimated, before the 2003 U.S. invasion. This new number puts Iraq's crude oil reserves as the second largest in the world, trailing only Saudi Arabia.
Dozens of NATO oil tankers have been set on fire by militants in Pakistan in the last week, killing over 10 people. The fuel convoys were destined for troops stationed in Afghanistan, but had been stalled, along with hundreds of other trucks, after Pakistan closed the northern Turkum border crossing. Only the southern crossing into Afghanistan has been open since last week, when an American helicopter shot down two Pakistani soldiers. The American government apologized for this incident on Wednesday, saying that the soldiers were mistaken for Pakistani militants.
Afghan and Arab sources report that Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Taliban representatives have begun secret talks to negotiate a peace agreement. Both government and Taliban spokespeople deny that any official negotiations are occurring. Yet, a number of unidentified sources have confirmed that discussions have already taken place with representatives authorized to speak on behalf of the Quetta Shura, a Pakistan-based Taliban group. In connection to this, the Afghan government's High Peace Council, a group intended to develop policies for negotiating with the Taliban, will convene for the first time on Thursday. A spokesperson for Karzai has asserted that no under-the-table discussions will occur outside of the Peace Council, meaning that the reported secret talks are in violation of this policy.
A recent Senate study has found that Afghan security contractors hired by the U.S. often have strong ties to local leaders connected to the Afghan insurgency. These connections have sometimes allowed Taliban warlords to access diverted Pentagon funds. The Armed Services Committee's report argues that these deals have been enabled by the lack of military oversight over local security contracts. Evidence from the report indicates that contractors have occasionally even operated directly against U.S. forces.
This month marks the 9th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. Since the American invasion in 2001, NATO has lost more than 2,000 troops. This includes more than 1,220 American servicemen and women. Casualties are running at an all-time high since the start of the war. Although President Obama has poured more troops into Afghanistan, public support for the war is falling in the United States and abroad. NATO members, such as the Netherlands and Canada, have already pulled out troops or are in the process of leaving. As the war enters its 10th year, questions remain of whether the U.S. and its allies will be successful in reversing the Taliban's resurgence in the region.
An American trade delegation visited Iraq this week for the first time in 3 decades. The delegation included Francisco Sanchez, the U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade, as well as representatives of 14 U.S. companies. Sanchez wanted to encourage American businesses to invest in Iraq's market. If they wait, they risk competing with other international businesses. Some U.S. businesses, such as Boeing and General Electric, have already started to invest in Iraq. And this week, Honeywell International opened its own office in Baghdad to produce equipment for the Iraqi oil and gas market. Yet, Sanchez expressed that the U.S. could still take more advantage of the opportunities to invest in Iraq. According to a 2009 study by Dunya Frontier Consultants, the U.S.'s private investment in Iraq consistently ranks in the bottom.
This is War News Radio. While many Americans are following the midterm elections for their political intrigue, a segment of the military is keeping a close eye on Congress for another reason. A shift in the balance of power may dramatically affect their lives. Sam Hirschman and Min Xuan Wen contributed to this report. Xuan has more on these soldiers and their supporters.
Most Americans oppose Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So do Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. President Obama said ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a priority in his State of the Union address.
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are.
But last month, Republicans blocked a Senate bill that would have ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Opponents see their window for congressional repeal slipping away and say that the costs of the policy are far too great for the military and for the American people. Jonathan Hopkins, a graduate of West Point and a former captain in the U.S. Army, was discharged in August 2010 because he's gay. When confronted, Hopkins wouldn't lie.
I was not about to, try and fake that I wasn't gay in order to stay in the military. To me, the cost was kind of too high. And the cost had been very, very high already. I just kind of hadn't realized that yet.
Hopkins is just one of about 14,000 U.S. service men and women who have been kicked out of the armed forces because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Most are good soldiers. Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't related to job performance. David Hall, a former Air Force staff sergeant discharged for being gay in 2002, thought he was pretty good.
I was well-respected at work for what I did and was promoted many times, received many awards.
But that didn't matter when another cadet turned him in to their commanding officer.
That pretty much ended my Air Force career.
Opponents say that driving out good soldiers is a main flaw of the policy. Sue Fulton is the communications director for Knights Out, an organization of West Point graduates that supports the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
This policy is damaging our military. Our whole point about Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't about equal rights. It's about strengthening the military. Don't Ask, Don't Tell weakens our military every day by kicking out good soldiers or by weakening good soldiers by keeping them, they're not allowed to talk about their lives with their comrades. It's crazy and it's bad for our Army.
Supporters of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on the other hand, say the armed forces will be hurt by repealing the policy. Fulton says evidence from NATO allies, most of whom allow gay service members to serve openly, doesn't show that.
Everything that we've learned from our NATO allies, all of whom have openly gay service members, except for Turkey doesn't, but all of our other NATO allies have openly gay service members. Everything that we've learned from them is that allowing open service was a non-event. There just were not any issues.
Since Congress rejected the repeal, opponents of Don't Ask, Don't Tell have been trying to decide what to do next. Diane Mazur, a law professor at the University of Florida and an expert on the military and Constitution, says the issue will fall to the courts by default.
It isn't really because courts are trying to seize control of this. It's that everyone has taken this issue, Congress and the president, and by their own inaction, I think they've dumped it in the courts. The court is the last adult left in the room.
And the courts are responding. The Log Cabin Republicans is an organization committed to getting equal rights for gay and lesbian Americans by working within the Republican Party. The group recently won a decision in the California District Court that struck down the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy as unconstitutional. But Christian Burle, the Deputy Executive Director of Log Cabin Republicans, describes a long road ahead.
We have been given every indication that that the president will appeal our ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then we feel confident that our argument would prevail if it comes to the Supreme Court.
Because the process in the courts could take years, activists are still looking to Congress for repeal. Hall, who now works for Service Members Legal Defense Network, an organization committed to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, has his sights set on December.
Our push will be to make sure, one, that a vote happens during the lame duck session, and two, that we have the 60 votes to move the bill. And that's not just pushing Congress, but at the same time, pushing the administration to help with that, calling up senators, especially on the Republican side, so that we have a bipartisan vote.
If Hall is right and Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed, he hopes to be in uniform again.
I definitely would want to go back in, when we do get Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed.
If gay service members are allowed to serve openly, the issue may just disappear. Jonathan Hopkins thinks someday people won't understand the controversy at all.
I think the best parallel to this is desegregation. You all know the decision by Harry Truman to overturn that was the right decision. You all know it.
Whether progress comes through Congress, the White House, or the courts, opponents already envision the military without Don't Ask, Don't Tell. For War News Radio, I'm Xuan Nguyen.
This is War News Radio. Since the beginning of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, over 2 million Iraqis have fled to neighboring countries, with over 1 million seeking asylum in Syria. The UN estimates that nearly 800,000 of that number are still residing there today, although many are not officially registered as refugees. As the Syrian government is not willing to accommodate them permanently, the situation of these Iraqis is becoming increasingly desperate. Emily Crawford reports in this piece, first aired in June.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq triggered an explosion of sectarian violence, especially after Saddam Hussein's fall from power. Until then, the minority sect of Arab Sunnis had been the dominant political force, but they lost influence along with Saddam, and a dramatic power struggle ensued. Uprooted by sectarian militias and the general chaos of a nation suddenly without government or infrastructure, there was a mass exodus of Iraqis. As the closest and most accessible of the surrounding countries, Syria was the obvious choice as a destination for the refugees. Deborah Amos, NPR foreign correspondent and author of the book Eclipse of the Sunnis, has devoted extensive research to the flight of these Iraqis and their lives in exile. She says that the majority of the refugees were the newly persecuted Sunnis.
It was overwhelmingly Sunnis who were leaving Baghdad. It was a demographic exodus, to be sure. It was also an exodus that was a middle-class exodus. These were the professionals from Baghdad, and that tended to be the Sunnis of Baghdad, the more educated people of Baghdad. It was the doctors, it was the lawyers, it was the school teachers, it was the poets, it was the television producers. It was the very people that the country was going to need to rebuild the nation, and they were leaving.
Although most of the refugees in Syria are Sunni, there are also significant numbers of Iraqi Christians, secular Shias, Kurds, and other marginalized minorities. Saddam's regime had been oppressive, but it had at least ensured a degree of stability in Iraq. With that gone, sectarian divisions became intensified. Ahmad Ibrahim al-Qarhi, an Iraqi artist who lived in Syria for 3 years before coming to the U.S., remembers the eruption of sectarian violence in Baghdad.
Honestly, I remember the day I left Baghdad because I felt like I was an outlaw. I did not have any other guilt except for that I was from one sect and living with another. And this wasn't present before the war. Everybody used to live together, the Christian, the Kurd, and the Shiite and the Sunni. But all of these concepts changed with the appearance of all the militias. The struggle for power started, so all these things happened.
The flight from Iraq was not easy for anybody. Ali Al-Azawi, a 22-year-old Iraqi living currently in a part of Damascus called Jarimana, was forced to drop everything in order to escape.
I left Iraq in 2005. I was studying in the Fine Arts Institute. I couldn't finish my studies. The situation and being forced to travel out of Iraq. I have a big family. If my family wasn't big, I could have completed my studies. Someone had to go down and work. We are 8 people with my grandmother, so it's hard for me to study.
Although Al-Azawi has been living in Syria for 5 years now, he still struggles to keep a steady job. Because refugees are not legally allowed to work there, employment must be actively sought on a daily basis.
On the passport, there is a stamp that says not to be employed. That is why Iraqis can't stick to one job. We work on a daily schedule. You work one day, quit the next day, work 10 days and stop working for 2 days, work for a month and stop working 10 days. So there isn't a stable employment, and we don't work one kind of job, but different ones.
Because work is so difficult to find in Syria, many Iraqis must resort to desperate measures in order to survive. More and more refugees who simply have no other options have turned to exploitative practices such as child labor and sex trafficking. Amos emphasizes the fact that in an illegal job economy, the burden of generating income for a family often falls upon the children.
Many of them resort to having their children work. It is easier for a young person to get a job, you know, putting charcoal into a nargila at a restaurant or working in the back room of a restaurant or even working in the gray economy in some factories where a kid can work for 12 hours where, you know, his professor father is really too old to work that long. And so you see a lot of kids in Damascus working, which means that these kids aren't in school. You are going to have a generation in Amman and in Damascus where children are not in school.
Children aren't the only ones who are making sacrifices so that their families can survive. According to Amos, 1 out of every 4 families of refugees in Syria are single-headed households. Many women are left alone because their husbands were killed in Iraq or abandoned them when the pressure of being in a mixed Sunni-Shia marriage became too great. As the savings that people brought with them run out, more women are resorting to sex work as a means for survival. This development is particularly surprising when one considers that the majority of Iraqi refugees are educated, middle-class people belonging to a conservative religious sect. Amos says that this contradiction demonstrates exactly how desperate the situation of these women is.
The fact of this prevalence of prostitution in Damascus is a sign that these people have lost all hope. Lost all hope of ever having a normal life again, lost all hope of ever going home again, that these are survival instincts. These are people who are down to the end of their rope, that the trauma that they've suffered in Iraq has been so overwhelming to them. Their will to survive is so strong that they are able to break through social taboos in their own society to take this on.
Amos also stressed that although nightclubs keep sex workers off the streets, they are still quite vulnerable to harassment and abuse.
There's no protection for these women, none at all. Prostitution is a crime in Syria, and if you are caught coming home at 4 o'clock in the morning, almost any policeman can pull you over and ask for the money that you made that night. And I have talked to women who say that happens to them. They've also been dragged into police stations and raped by policemen.
The hardships that Iraqis have encountered in exile are extreme, and Amos's stories of her visits to Syria are testimony to that. However, Al-Azawi emphasizes that many refugees feel affectionately about Syria as their country of asylum.
Syria as a country has been good to us. It's true that you are a refugee, but it's the only country which has been good to us. It's opened its borders. Although, they require a visa. But it's nothing to pay $50 for a visa if you compare it to other countries.
If it were possible, many Iraqis might be willing to make Syria their permanent home. However, Al-Azawi says that the inability to work and the fact that visas must be renewed every 3 to 6 months prevent any serious thoughts of permanent relocation.
You cannot settle in this country. That's our main problem. It's impossible to build a life here. If you want to settle in some place, the important factor is a permanent job. 90% of Iraqis in Syria are waiting to get out of Syria. Not one single Iraqi thinks about settling here in Syria.
Some refugees, like Al-Karhi, have relocated once more to the United States or to other countries where they can settle permanently. But this is an option that few can afford. Until the situation in Iraq improves, it would seem that the majority of Iraqis in Syria are stuck waiting. Waiting for jobs, waiting for resettlement, waiting until they can return home. For War News Radio, I'm Emily Crawford.
This is War News Radio. The Afghan government has made gestures in the name of progress, such as the recent peace jirga, but they've been criticized as shallow and ineffectual. The idea of a full-fledged peace movement in Afghanistan might seem far-fetched, but an organized effort by the Afghan people may be what's really needed. Karim Saryahmed reports on the initial sparks of an Afghan peace movement in this piece, first aired in July.
Afghanistan's National Consultative Peace Jirga convened on June 2nd. Just before the war in Afghanistan surpassed Vietnam as the longest war in the history of the United States. President Hamid Karzai called upon the Taliban to join in peace efforts and reintegrate themselves into society, addressing them as brothers. The Taliban would only comply if international forces in Afghanistan withdrew, and representatives from the Taliban were not even invited to the peace jirga. Israr Ahmed Karimzai, president of Awakened Youth Association, a network of Afghan youth organizations, had high hopes for the peace jirga and believes that it was productive. However, he finds the demands of both sides unreasonable.
The Taliban asked for the withdrawal of international troops, and the government asked them to lay down their weapons. These requirements are very extreme. To ask international troops to withdraw would be like destroying Afghanistan. On the other hand, you can't ask your armed opposition, who has more control over the country than you have. They will say, "Why shall we put down our weapons? You need to sit down to negotiate on things."
Wajma Fo, the Afghanistan country director for the NGO Global Rights and a recipient of the International Women of Courage Award, thought President Karzai's refusal to even discuss the demands of the Taliban was a mistake. She saw the jirga as flawed on some very basic levels. She says the whole process was one-sided, and that President Karzai essentially told the jirga what conclusions to come to. Ms. Fo also considers it a contradiction to have counterinsurgency and reintegration at the same time.
How can you reintegrate people who are you killing in the counterinsurgency operations? And I think it was a very dangerous idea. I don't know who presented this to the Afghan government or to the international communities, that you can talk at the same time and you can kill at the same time.
Afghans who have suffered for decades are frustrated with their government, and young people who run out of options often join the insurgency. The government is aware of this issue, but the problem, according to Ms. Fo, is that the government does not take responsibility for its own people because it is corrupt and impotent.
There are many people who are angry because of the government of Afghanistan, me included. But I didn't pick up arms, or I didn't pick up guns, and I didn't explode myself. And we have nonviolent ways of resisting.
Recently, in the northern province of Faryab, militants burned down an entire village and just left.
So the people had demonstration. They asked the parliamentarians that we have been the people who tolerated even the failure of the government. We have been the people who have tolerated even the injustices of the government, but still we are being ignored and we are being deprived.
Ms. Fo has talked to many youth groups in northern and central Afghanistan who feel ignored, and that they lack even international support. Enayet Safi, who has worked through the UN with youth organizations for the past 6 years, has been working to establish representative youth councils. Safi puts a lot of faith in the potential of young Afghans.
Out of the number of people we have so far been able to contact, there have been very, very positive and very good reactions. Because, you know, youth around the world, they're full of energy, they're full of hope, no matter how difficult their situation is. I mean, if nobody else is taking care of you, why don't you take care of your own future? Why don't you take your own future in your hands? For how long are we going to wait for people to make decisions for us?
Safi understands the limitations of organizing young people to solve the country's most deep-rooted problems, but he is undeterred.
A post-war Afghanistan is going to be a very young Afghanistan. It is going to be the Afghanistan that will belong to the young generation. Now, we all understand what is the priority for the young generation of Afghanistan. It is education, and it is education that brings stability, that brings peace, and that puts an end to a conflict.
Awakened Youth of Afghanistan has a Facebook group, of which Safi is a member. While perusing the list of members, I realized that they were almost all men. I asked Safi if women were playing an active role in the youth movement.
Of course not. I mean, the young women are confined, they are restricted, and they are denied a lot of opportunities that men are not, okay? Now, that is what we're going to do. I mean, this is a step-by-step process. We've got to be very careful here. You see, we do not have a political support yet. We do not have a political backing yet. And we should not be very radical in trying to immediately modernize the concept.
Wajma Fo says that, though often limited by social standing, education, or simply location, many Afghan women have been leading peace initiatives for years.
Although you don't hear about it, it's not a very kind of fashionable news that would kind of attract attention. But in the past 9 years, women organizations, they have had initiatives for peace, they have had prayers for peace. Even I have been part of a regional talks for peace with the Pakistani women on the other side of the region.
Fo says that Afghan women do not want the international community or the U.S. to come and save them. The issue for both young Afghans and Afghan women is that they lack the support of their government. But it seems that there is at least a small group ready to fight for their future.
There are these limitations that are prompting me to work more harder and more harder than if there were none of these challenges that we are facing at the moment. So I'm well aware of these challenges, and I can tell you that. I mean, it takes time, okay, but it is never late or too early to start. We are just in the right moment to start.
For War News Radio, I'm Kerim Sari Ahmed.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Sam Hirschman, Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Jonathan Kwan, Amandine Lee, Aaron Moser, and Sage Wagner. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Anjali Kadambi.
And I'm Marina Tuk-Tuk. Until next time, thanks for listening.